Nor was his long-standing relationship with Eva Braun, one of Hoffman's employees whom he had first met in autumn 1929, an exception. To him, remarked Hoffman, she was just an attractive little thing, in whom, in spite of her inconsequential and feather-brained outlook, or perhaps just because of it, he found the type of relaxation and repose he sought. But never, in voice, look, or gesture, did he ever behave in a way that suggested any deeper interest in her. It was different with Geli. Whatever the exact nature of the relationship, and all accounts are based heavily upon guesswork and hearsay, it seems certain that Hitler, for the first and only time in his life, if we leave his mother out of consideration, became emotionally dependent on a woman. Whether his involvement with Geli was explicitly sexual cannot be known beyond doubt. Some have hinted darkly at the incestuous relationships in Hitler's ancestry, presumably along the lines that he was keeping incest in the family. But lurid stories of alleged deviant sexual practices put about by Otto Strasser ought to be viewed as the fanciful anti-Hitler propaganda of an outright political enemy. Other tales, also to be treated with scepticism, circulated of a compromising letter and of pornographic drawings by Hitler that had to be bought off a blackmailer by the party treasurer Schwarz. But whether actively sexual or not, Hitler's behaviour towards Geli has all the traits of a strong, latent at least, sexual dependence. This manifested itself in such extreme shows of jealousy and domineering possessiveness that a crisis in the relationship was inevitable. Geli, broad-featured, with dark brown, wavy hair, was no stunning beauty, but nonetheless, all accounts agree, a vivacious, extrovert, attractive young woman. She livened up the gatherings in Café Heck. Hitler allowed her, something he permitted no one else, to become the centre of attraction. He took her everywhere with him, to the theatre, concerts, the opera, the cinema, restaurants, for drives in the countryside, picnics, even shopping for clothes. He sang her praises, showed her off. Geli was in Munich ostensibly to study at the university, but little studying was done. Hitler paid for singing lessons for her, but she was clearly never going to make an operatic heroine. She was bored by her lessons. She was more interested in having a good time. Flighty and flirtatious, she had no shortage of male admirers and was not backward in encouraging them. When Hitler found out about Geli's liaison with Emil Maurice, his bodyguard and chauffeur, there was such a scene that Maurice feared Hitler was going to shoot him. He was soon forced out of Hitler's employment. Geli was sent to cool her ardour under the watchful eye of Frau Bruckmann. Hitler's jealous possessiveness took on pathological proportions. If she went out without him, Geli was chaperoned and had to be home early. Everything she did was monitored and controlled. She was effectively a prisoner. She resented it bitterly. "My uncle is a monster," she is reported as saying. "No one can imagine what he demands of me." By mid-September 1931, she had had enough. She planned to return to Vienna. It was later rumoured that she had a new boyfriend there, even that he was a Jewish artist whose child she was expecting. Geli's mother, Angela Raubal, told American interrogators after the war that her daughter had wanted to marry a violinist from Linz, but that she and her half-brother, Adolf, had forbidden her to see the man. At any rate, it seems certain that Geli was desperate to get away from her uncle's clutches. Whether he had been physically maltreating her is again impossible to ascertain. It was said that her nose was broken and there were other indications of physical violence when her body was found. Once more, the evidence is too flimsy to be certain, and the story was one put out by Hitler's political enemies. The police doctor who examined the body and two women who laid out the corpse found no wounds or bleeding on the face. But that Hitler was, at the very least, subjecting his niece to intense psychological pressure cannot be doubted. According to the version put out a few days later by the socialist Münchener Post, vehemently denied in a public statement by Hitler, during a heated argument on Friday the 18th of September, he refused to let her go to Vienna. Later that day, Hitler and his entourage departed for Nuremberg. He had already left his hotel the next morning when he was urgently recalled to be told the news that Geli had been found dead in his apartment, shot with his revolver. He immediately raced back to Munich in such a rush that his car was stopped by the police for speeding about halfway between Nuremberg and Munich. Hitler's political enemies had a field day. There were no holds barred on the newspaper reports. Stories of violent rows and physical mistreatment mingled with sexual innuendo and even the allegation that Hitler had either killed Gelly himself or had had her murdered to prevent scandal. Hitler himself was not in Munich when his niece died, and it is not easy to see the reasoning for a commissioned murder to prevent a scandal being carried out in his own flat. As it was, the scandal was enormous. The party's own line that the killing had been an accident, which had occurred when Gelly was playing with Hitler's gun, also lacked all conviction. The truth will never be known, but suicide, possibly intended as a creed de coeur that went wrong, driven by the need to escape from the vice of her uncle's clammy possessiveness and, perhaps, violent jealousy, seems the most likely explanation. Hitler appears to have been near hysterical, then fallen into an intense depression. Those close to him had never seen him in such a state. He seemed to be on the verge of a nervous breakdown. He spoke of giving up politics and finishing it all. There were fears that he might be suicidal. Hans Frank's account implies that his despair at the scandal and press campaign against him outweighed any personal grief during these days. He took refuge in the house of his publisher, Adolf Müller, on the shores of the Tegernsee. Frank used legal means to block the press attacks, and once he had visited Gelly's grave in Vienna's sprawling central cemetery, a few days after the funeral, Hitler was suddenly able to snap out of his depression. All at once, the crisis was over. At his first speech a few days later in Hamburg, he received an even more rapturous reception than usual. According to one person who was there, he looked very strained, anger-griffen, but spoke well. He was back in business. More than ever, the orgiastic frenzy he worked himself up into during his big public addresses, and the response he encountered in what he saw as the feminine mass, provided a substitute for the emptiness and lack of emotional bonds in his private life. Some who saw Hitler at close quarters were convinced that Gelly could have exerted a restraining influence upon him. It is a highly dubious theory. His emotional involvement with Gelly, whatever its precise nature, was, everything points to this, more intense than any other human relationship he had before or after. There was something both obsessive and cloyingly sentimental about the way her rooms in the Prinz Regentenplatz apartment and in Haus Wachenfeld were turned into shrines. In a personal sense, Gelly was indeed irreplaceable, though Hitler soon enough had Eva Braun in tow. But it was a purely selfish dependency on Hitler's part. Gelly had been allowed to have no existence of her own. Hitler's own extreme dependency insisted that she should be totally dependent upon him. In human terms, it was a self-destructive relationship. Politically, apart from the short-lived scandal, it was of no significance. It is difficult to imagine Gelly turning Hitler away from his deeper, less personal obsession with power. Nor was his embittered thirst for vengeance and destruction altered by her death. History would have been no different had Gelly Raubal survived. 9. Little over a week after Gelly's death, the city elections in the relatively unresponsive territory of Hamburg gave the Nazis 26.2% of the vote, ahead of the communists and only fractionally behind the SPD. With as high a vote as 37.2% in rural Oldenburg the previous May, the NSDAP had become for the first time the largest party in a state parliament. In the last state elections of the year in Hessen, on the 15th of November, this feat was repeated in a remarkable poll that gave the Nazis, with 37.1%, a higher proportion of the vote than the communists and socialists put together, and 27 seats in a Landtag where they had previously been unrepresented. The electoral landslide showed no signs of abating. With the Brüning government under siege, ruling by emergency decree, its policies, calculated to demonstrate Germany's inability to pay reparations, sending the economy plummeting to disaster in a catastrophic downward spiral of cascading production levels and soaring levels of unemployment and social misery, more and more voters were cursing the wretched republic. By the time of the calamitous bank crash in July, when two of Germany's major banks, the Darmstädter and the Dresdner, collapsed, Those voters, looking to the survival and recovery of democracy, were in a dwindling minority. But what sort of authoritarian solution might follow the liquidation of the Weimar Republic was still anything but clear. Germany's power elites were no more united on this issue than were the mass of the population. With the levels of popular support the Nazis now enjoyed, no potential right-wing solution could afford to leave them out of the equation. In July, Hugenberg, the leader of the DNVP, and Franz Zelter, the head of the huge veterans organization, the Stahlhelm, had renewed their alliance with Hitler, resurrecting the former grouping to fight the Young Plan in the national opposition. Hugenberg assuaged the criticisms of Reich President Hindenburg, who thought the Nazis not only vulgar but dangerous socialists, by assuring him that he was politically educating them towards the national cause to prevent them slipping into socialism or communism. Hitler's line was, as ever, pragmatic. The publicity and contacts won through allying with Hugenberg were valuable, but he made sure he kept his distance. At the highly publicized rally of nationalist opposition forces at Bad Harzburg on the 11th of October, resulting in the creation of the Harzburg Front, and a manifesto, which he thought worthless, demanding new Reichstag elections and the suspension of emergency legislation, Hitler stood for the march past of the SA, then demonstratively left before the Stahlhelm could begin, having left them waiting for 25 minutes. He also refused to attend the joint lunch of the nationalist leaders. He could not suppress his repulsion at such meals, he wrote, deflecting the criticism of his behavior into a further advertisement for his image as a leader who shared the privations of his followers. When thousands of my supporters undertake service only at very great personal sacrifice, and in part with hungry stomachs. A week later, to underline the NSDAP's independent strength, he took the salute at a march past of 104,000 SA and SS men in Braunschweig, the largest Nazi paramilitary demonstration to date. Among those taking part at Bad Harzburg, and whose presence there made a stir, was the former president of the Reichsbank, Hjalmar Schacht, now turned political adventurer. Some other figures, though not prominent ones, from the world of business were also there. Schacht, a Freemason and founding member of the pro-Republican DDP, was an unlikely fellow traveller of Nazism. But he had moved strongly to the right after resigning the presidency of the Reichsbank in March 1930, in protest at the ways of implementing the Young Plan, and had publicly expressed admiration for vitality of the NSDAP in December 1930. Goering, with whom he was on good terms, arranged for Schacht to come to dinner and meet Hitler on the 5th of January 1931. The dinner was also attended by another Nazi sympathizer from big business, Fritz Thyssen, the chairman of the supervisory board of the United Steelworks. Hitler arrived, wearing party uniform, only after the meal was over. As usual, he dominated the conversation, contributing, thought Schacht, some 95% of what was said. Even so, Schacht, intelligent and with sharply critical acumen, was impressed. His skill in exposition was most striking. Everything he said, he demonstrated as incontrovertible truth. Nevertheless, his ideas were not unreasonable and were entirely free from any propagandist pathos. He spoke with moderation and was obviously anxious to avoid anything that might shock us in our capacity as representatives of a more traditional society. The thing that impressed me most about this man was his absolute conviction of the rightness of his outlook and his determination to translate this outlook into practical action. Even at this first meeting, it was obvious to me that Hitler's power of propaganda would have a tremendous pull with the German population if we did not succeed in overcoming the economic crisis and weaning the masses from radicalism. Hitler was obsessed, by his own words, a thorough fanatic with the most powerful effect on his audience, a born agitator in spite of a hoarse, sometimes broken and not infrequently croaking voice. Schacht tried at the time to persuade Brüning to include the NSDAP in a coalition, presuming the responsibilities of government would have tamed it. Thyssen, attracted by the corporatist ideas in the NSDAP's program, had similarly advocated working with the Nazis to the Chancellor. Neither Schacht nor Thyssen was, however, representative of the leaders of big business. During the 1920s, big business had not surprisingly shown little interest in the NSDAP, a fringe party in the doldrums without, it seemed, any prospect of power or influence. The election result of 1930 had compelled the business community to take note of Hitler's party. A series of meetings were arranged at which Hitler explained his aims to prominent businessmen. At the end of September 1930, he put his views to the former chancellor and current head of the Hamburg-America shipping line, Wilhelm Kuno, who was rumored to be contemplating running for Reich president with NSDAP support when Hindenburg's term of office expired in 1932. Kuno was impressed with Hitler, who advanced a moderate economic program, upholding capitalist enterprise, and even claiming that there would be no violent persecution of Jews under Nazi rule. Hitler also spoke again at the Hamburger Nationalclub, a meeting arranged by Kuno, and to a group of Ruhr industrialists at the home of Emil Kierdorf, the aged Ruhr coal magnate and long-standing Nazi sympathizer, near Mülheim. Further meetings with a number of business leaders arranged by Walter Funk, the former editor of the financial newspaper, the Berliner Börsenzeitung, followed early in 1931 in Hitler's suite at the Kaiserhof Hotel, at which considerable funding was reportedly pledged in the event of an attempted left-wing coup. The reassurances given by Hitler at such meetings, as well as by Goering, who had good links to top businessmen, were, however, not able to dispel the worries of most business leaders that the NSDAP was a socialist party with radical anti-capitalist aims. Hitler was seen by many of them as a moderate, but whatever favorable impression Hitler himself was able to make, it was insufficient to remove the socialist image of his party in the eyes of many businessmen. The NSDAP's support of the Berlin metalworkers' strike in autumn 1930 and the participation of the Nazis' surrogate trade union, the Nationalsozialistische Betriebszellenorganisation, NSBO, National Socialist Factory Cell Organization, in four strikes the following year, alongside the continued anti-capitalist rhetoric of some party spokesmen, seemed active proof of its dangerous tendencies. Despite growing disillusionment with the Brüning administration, most captains of industry retained their healthy skepticism about the Hitler movement during 1931. There were exceptions, such as Thyssen, but in general it was the owners of smaller and medium-sized concerns who found the NSDAP an increasingly attractive proposition. The story put about in the memoirs of the later press chief Otto Dietrich of Hitler ceaselessly touring Germany in his big Mercedes in the second half of 1931, cultivating big business leaders and breaking down their resistance to the NSDAP, was no more than part of the myth that Hitler had won power by conquering the hearts and minds of every section of the German people. No more solidly founded was the view of the left at the time that the Nazi movement was the creature of big business and sustained by its funding. Most leaders and executives of big business were shrewd enough to spread their funding round as a form of political insurance once the Nazi breakthrough had taken place. But most of it still went to the Nazis' political opponents on the conservative right. The leaders of big business were no friends of democracy, but nor, for the most part, did they want to see the Nazis running the country. This remained the case throughout most of 1932, a year dominated by election campaigns in which the Weimar state disintegrated into all-embracing crisis. Hitler's much-publicized address on the 27th of January 1932 to a gathering of some 650 members of the Dusseldorf Industry Club in the grand ballroom of Dusseldorf's Park Hotel did nothing, despite the later claims of Nazi propaganda, to alter the skeptical stance of big business. The response to his speech was mixed, but many were disappointed that he had nothing new to say, avoiding all detailed economic issues by taking refuge in his well-trodden political panacea for all ills. And there were indications that workers in the party were not altogether happy at their leader fraternizing with industrial leaders. Intensified anti-capitalist rhetoric, which Hitler was powerless to quell, worried the business community as much as ever. During the presidential campaigns of spring 1932, most business leaders stayed firmly behind Hindenburg and did not favor Hitler. And during the Reichstag campaigns of summer and autumn, the business community overwhelmingly supported the parties that backed the cabinet of Franz von Papen, from a Westphalian aristocratic family, married to the daughter of a Saarland industrialist, well-connected to industrial leaders, landowners, and Reichswehr officers, a somewhat lightweight, dilettante politician, but one who epitomized the ingrained conservatism, reactionary tendencies, and desire for a return to traditional authoritarianism of the German upper class. He was the establishment figure, Hitler the outsider, and in some respects unknown quantity. Papen, not Hitler, was not surprisingly then the favorite of big business. Only in autumn 1932, when Papen was ousted by Kurt von Schleicher, the general at the heart of most political intrigues, maker and breaker of governments, did the attitude of most leading figures in business, worried by the new chancellor's approach to the economy and opening to the trade unions, undergo a significant change. The NSDAP's funding continued before the seizure of power to come overwhelmingly from the dues of its own members and the entrance fees to party meetings. Such financing as came from fellow travellers in big business accrued more to the benefit of individual Nazi leaders than the party as a whole. Goering, needing a vast income to cater for his outsized appetite for high living and material luxury, quite especially benefited from such largesse. Thiessen in particular gave him generous subsidies, which Goering, given to greeting visitors to his splendidly adorned Berlin apartment dressed in a red toga and pointed slippers, looking like a sultan in a harem, found no difficulty in spending on a lavish lifestyle. Walter Funk, one of Hitler's links to leading industrialists, also used his contacts to line his own pockets. Gregor Strasser, too, was a recipient. Corruption at all levels was endemic. It would be surprising if none of such donations had reached Hitler. Indeed, Goering is alleged to have said that he passed on to Hitler some of the funding he received from Ruhr industrialists. Hitler had from the earliest years of his career, as we have seen, been supported by generous donations from benefactors. But by the early 1930s, he was less dependent on financial support from private patrons, even if his celebrity status now unquestionably brought him many unsolicited donations. His sources of income have remained largely in the dark. They were kept highly secret and totally detached from party finances. Schwarz, the party treasurer, had no insight into Hitler's own funds, but his taxable income alone, and much was doubtless left undeclared, trebled in 1930 to 48,472 marks as sales of Mein Kampf soared following his election triumph. That alone was more than Funk had earned from a year's salary as editor of a Berlin daily. Though for image purposes he repeatedly emphasized that he drew no salary from the party, nor any fee for the speeches he delivered on its behalf, he received hidden fees in the form of lavish expenses calculated on the size of the takings at his meetings. In addition, he was paid handsomely for the articles he contributed to the Völkische Beobachter, and between 1928 and 1931 to the Illustrierte Beobachter. And, with the foreign press now clamoring for interviews, another door to a lucrative source of income opened. Partly subsidized, if indirectly, by the party, partly drawing substantial royalties from his stated occupation as a writer, and partly benefiting from unsolicited donations from admirers, Hitler's sources of income were more than adequate to cover the costs of an affluent lifestyle. His proclaimed modest demands in matters of food and clothes, a constant element of his image as a humble man of the people, fell within a context of chauffeur-driven Mercedes, luxury hotels, grand residences, and a personal livery of bodyguards and attendants. 10. During 1932, the terminal nature of Weimar's ailing democracy became unmistakable. A prelude to the drama to follow had its setting in the presidential election in the spring. Reich President Hindenburg's seven-year term of office was due to expire on the 5th of May 1932. In the prevailing conditions of economic depression and political turmoil, the prospect of a bitterly contested election for the presidency was hardly enticing. But the chances of the parties agreeing on a single candidate were zero. Moves, initially prompted by Papen, had already therefore been afoot since the previous autumn to have the 84-year-old war hero, Paul von Hindenburg und Benneckendorff, confirmed by the Reichstag for a further period in office without the need for a divisive election. But a constitutional change would be required to achieve this, necessitating a two-thirds majority in the Reichstag. This could only be obtained if the National Socialists and DNVP were prepared to support it. Hitler was summoned early in January 1932 to a meeting in Berlin with the Reich Defense and acting Interior Minister Wilhelm Groner and Hindenburg's State Secretary Otto Meissner, where the proposition was put to him. Hitler did not commit himself immediately, but the Nazi leadership recognized that such a move could only strengthen Brüning's position. The Chancellor's tactics had put them on the spot. "The chess match for power begins," noted Goebbels. A week later, Hitler notified the Chancellor of his party's rejection of the proposal on constitutional, foreign political, domestic, and moral grounds. A rancorous public exchange with Brüning followed. How genuine Hitler's constitutional scruples were became clear in his offer to support Hindenburg's candidacy if the Reich president dismissed Brüning and announced new Reichstag and Prussian elections, following which the newly elected Reichstag, which Hitler was confident of controlling, would extend his period of office. Hindenburg's refusal, expected though it was, left Hitler in a quandary. In the event of presidential elections, he could scarcely refrain from standing. Not to stand would be incomprehensible and a massive disappointment to his millions of supporters. They might start to turn away from a leader who shied away from the challenge. On the other hand, a personal contest between the corporal and the field marshal, between the upstart political adventurer and the revered hero of Tannenberg, widely regarded as the symbol of national values above the fray of party politics, could hardly be expected to result in a victory for Hitler. Faced with his dilemma, Hitler dithered for more than a month before deciding to run for president. Goebbels was almost in despair at the indecision, as party morale wavered and Hitler preoccupied himself with grandiose schemes for rebuilding Berlin. At last, on the 22nd of February, Goebbels was given permission to announce Hitler's candidacy during his speech at a big rally in the Sportpalast that evening. "Thank God," was the propaganda chief's reaction. The cheering following the announcement lasted for 10 minutes. Goebbels's barely concealed criticism of Hitler's leadership in the past weeks was immediately dispelled. "He is and remains our leader," he reminded himself, and a few days later he added that the Führer was again on top of the situation. A technicality had to be cleared up. Hitler was still not a German citizen. Previous ideas of attaining citizenship for him in Bavaria in 1929 and Thuringia the following year had foundered. He remained stateless. Rapid steps were now taken to appoint Hitler to the post of Regierungsrat, government councillor in the Office of State Culture and Measurement, Landeskultur und Vermessungsamt, in Braunschweig, and as a state representative in Berlin. Through his nomination as a civil servant, Hitler acquired German citizenship. On the 26th of February 1932, he swore his oath as a civil servant to the German state he was determined to destroy. Just how far the political center of gravity had shifted to the right was shown by the perverse alignments in the presidential election campaign. Hindenburg was dependent for support on the socialists and Catholics, who had formed his main opposition 7 years earlier and made strange and unwelcome bedfellows for the staunchly Protestant and arch-conservative doyen of the military caste. The bourgeois right, headed by Hugenberg, refused Hindenburg their support. Showing how fragile the professed unity of the Habsburg front had been, they also denied it to Hitler. But their largely unknown nominee, the deputy leader of the Stahlhelm, Theodor Düsterberg, was hardly a serious candidate. On the left, the communists nominated their leader, Ernst Thälmann, sure of support only from his own camp. It was plain from the outset, therefore, that the main contenders were Hindenburg and Hitler. Equally plain was the Nazi message. A vote for Hitler was a vote for change. Under Hindenburg, things would stay as they were. "Old man, you must step aside," proclaimed Hitler at a rally attended by an estimated 25,000 in the Berlin Sportpalast on the 27th of February. The Nazi propaganda machine went into top gear. The country was engulfed during the first of 5 major campaigns that year, with a veritable flood of Nazi meetings, parades, and rallies, accompanied by the usual pageantry and razzmatazz. Hitler himself, his indecision resolved, poured all his energies, as usual, into his speaking tournées, travelling the length and breadth of Germany, and addressing huge crowds in 12 cities during the 11-day campaign. In Breslau, he arrived 4 hours late, in Stuttgart, 2 hours behind schedule. The crowds still waited. The Völkischer Beobachter claimed, though certainly with some exaggeration, that he spoke, in all, to around 500,000 people. Expectations were built up. "Everywhere there's a victory mood," wrote Goebbels on election day, the 13th of March. But he added, cautiously, "I'm somewhat skeptical." He shared the bitter disappointment and depression of Hitler's supporters when the results were announced. The 30% won by Hitler was more or less in line with expectations, though lower than the NSDAP's showing in the Oldenburg and Hessen state elections the previous year. But Thälmann, with only 13%, had done less well than anticipated. Duisterberg had gained under 7%, and the SPD supporters, whatever their distaste for the president, had evidently stuck by Hindenburg, whose vote had, therefore, held up well. With over 49% of almost 38 million votes cast, the Reich president ended up a mere 170,000 votes short of the absolute majority. There had to be a second round. This time, Nazi propaganda had a new gimmick. Hitler took to the skies in a hired plane, American style, in his first Germany flight, Deutschlandflug, embellished with the slogan of the Führer over Germany. Flying from city to city in a truncated campaign, squeezed into less than a week to accommodate an Easter truce in politicking, Hitler was able to hold 20 major speeches in different venues before huge audiences, totaling close to 1 million persons. It was a remarkable electioneering performance, the like of which had never before been seen in Germany. This time, there was no disappointment in the Nazi camp. Hindenburg, with 53%, was re-elected, but while Thälmann had slumped to only 10%, Hitler had increased his support to 37%. He had done much more than merely save face. Well over 13 million, 2 million more than in the first round, had voted for him. The Führer cult, the manufactured commodity of Nazi propaganda, and once the property of a tiny collection of fanatics, was now on the way to being sold to a third of the German population. Quite literally, while the votes were being counted, Goebbels was laying the preparations for the next battle, the series of state elections on the 24th of April in Prussia, Bavaria, Württemberg, and Anhalt, and the city elections in Hamburg. All in all, this amounted to about 4/5 of the country. Without a break, the frenetic campaigning continued. In his second Germany flight between the 16th and the 24th of April, Hitler, this time taking his campaign not just to the cities but deep into the provinces, gave 25 big speeches. In small towns in provincial backwaters, the impact was enormous. Nothing had been seen like it before. At Miesbach, in Upper Bavaria, the local press described Hitler's speech as an unprecedented sensation. Thousands had waited for hours in pouring rain for it. Elsewhere, it was Führer weather. The April sun shone, as in summer, turning everything into a picture of happiest expectation, wrote Luise Solmitz, a Hamburg schoolteacher, about the atmosphere in which Hitler addressed over 120,000 people crowded onto the speedway track at Lorchstedt in the Hamburg district on the 23rd of April. The streams of people arriving by foot and unloading from trains seemed endless. Most had a lengthy wait to see their hero. Frau Solmitz herself was there 2.5 hours before Hitler was due to speak. But the massive crowd was well-behaved, controlled only by stewards with the police keeping in the background. Most of those attending were already attracted to the Nazi cause. "No one said Hitler, always just the Führer," recorded Frau Solmitz. "The Führer says, the Führer wants, and what he said and wanted, that seemed good and proper." Her description continued. The hours passed, the sun shone, the expectation mounted. It got to 3 o'clock. "The Führer's coming," a thrill goes through the masses. Around the platform, hands could be seen raised in the Hitler greeting. There stood Hitler, in a simple black coat, looking expectantly over the crowd. A forest of swastika banners rustled upwards. The jubilation of the moment gave vent to a rousing cry of Heil. Then Hitler spoke. Main idea, out of the parties, a people, Volk, will emerge, the German people. He castigated the system. For the rest, he refrained from personal attacks and also unspecific and specific promises. His voice was hoarse from speaking so much in previous days. When the speech was over, there were roars of jubilation and applause. Hitler saluted, gave his thanks. The Germany anthem sounded over the track. Hitler was helped into his coat. Then he went. How many looked to him in touching faith as the helper, savior, the redeemer from overgreat distress? To him who rescues the Russian prince, the scholar, the clergyman, the peasant, the worker, the unemployed, out of the party, into the people. The results were closely in line with the votes won by Hitler in the runoff presidential election. Leader and party were largely indistinguishable in the eyes of the voters. In the giant state of Prussia, embracing two-thirds of Reich territory, the NSDAP's vote of 36.3% made it easily the largest party, now far ahead of the SPD, which had been the dominant party since 1919. Since the previous election in 1928, the Nazis had held 6 seats in the Prussian Landtag. Now they had 162 seats. In Bavaria, with 32.5%, they came to within 0.1% of the ruling BVP. In Württemberg, they rose from 1.8% in 1928 to 26.4%. In Hamburg, they attained 31.2%. And in Anhalt, with 40.9%, they could nominate the first Nazi minister-president of a German state. "It's a fantastic victory that we've attained," noted Goebbels, with justification. But, he added, "we must come to power in the foreseeable future. Otherwise, we'll win ourselves to death in elections." Mobilizing the masses was in itself going to be insufficient, Goebbels was recognizing. Despite the immense gains over the previous 3 years, there were signs that the limits of mobilization were being reached. The way ahead was still anything but clear. But another door was about to open. 11. The state election campaign had been fought in the wake of a ban on the SA and SS. Chancellor Brüning and Interior and Defense Minister Groener, under pressure from the state authorities, had persuaded Hindenburg 3 days after the president's re-election to dissolve all military-like, militärähnliche organizations of the NSDAP. The dissolution was directly occasioned by the Prussian police's discovery, following a tip-off to Reich Minister of the Interior Groener, in raids on Nazi Party offices, shortly after the first round of the presidential election, of material indicating the SA's readiness for a takeover of power by force following an electoral victory by Hitler. Despite Hitler's repeated declarations that he would come to power by legal means, the concerns of the authorities about the putschist intentions within the party, particularly within the SA, had persisted. The sensational discovery the previous autumn of the Boxheimer documents, named after the place in Hessen, the Boxheimer Hof, where they were found, outlining Nazi plans for taking power by force, had strongly underlined the justification for such concern. Actually, the Boxheimer documents had amounted to a half-baked concoction of measures to be taken in the event of a Nazi takeover of state power following the smashing of a communist attempted putsch, devised on his own initiative by the ambitious head of the party's legal section in Gauhessen, Werner Best. At the time, an embarrassed Hitler, whose claim to have known nothing of the incriminating material was in fact correct, had satisfied Groener with a renewed declaration of his legal intentions. But there had been distinct signs during the presidential election campaigns that the SA, now close to 400,000 strong, was straining at the leash. Talk of a putsch attempt by the left in the event of a Hitler victory was in the air. The SA had been placed on nationwide alarm. But instead of action, the stormtroopers had sat depressed in their quarters after Hitler's defeat. Goebbels noted the impatience of the SA again on the 2nd of April, commenting that a premature strike with force could destroy Nazi hopes at one fell swoop. News of the impending ban leaked to the Nazi leadership 2 days before it was imposed. Some preparations could therefore be made to retain the SA as distinct units within the party organization by simply reclassing the stormtroopers now as ordinary party members. And since the left also had its paramilitary organizations, which did not fall under the Groner dissolution order, the authorities had delivered the Nazis a further effective propaganda weapon which Hitler was quick to exploit. More importantly, the SA ban opened up the machinations that were to undermine the position not only of Groner, but of Brüning too, and to move the Reich government sharply to the right. The key figure was to be General von Schleicher, head of the Ministerial Office, the Army's political bureau, in the Reichswehr Ministry, and seen up to now as Groner's protégé. Schleicher's aim was an authoritarian regime, resting on the Reichswehr, with support from the National Socialists. The idea was to tame Hitler and incorporate the valuable elements from his movement into what would have been essentially a military dictatorship with populist backing. Schleicher opposed the ban on the SA, therefore, which he wanted as a feeder organization for an expanded Reichswehr once the reparations issue was out of the way. In secret talks with Schleicher on the 28th of April, Hitler had learnt that the Reichswehr leadership no longer supported Brüning. He followed this on the 7th of May with what Goebbels described as a decisive discussion with General Schleicher, attended by some of Hindenburg's immediate entourage. "Brüning is to go in the next days," he added. "The Reich president will withdraw his confidence. The plan is to install a presidential cabinet. The Reichstag will be dissolved. All coercive laws will be dropped. We will be given freedom of action and will then deliver a masterpiece of propaganda." Removal of the SA ban and new elections were, then, Hitler's price for supporting a new right-wing cabinet. With the emphasis on elections, it is clear that Hitler thought, as always, essentially of little more than coming to power by winning over the masses. Brüning was able to survive longer than the conspirators had imagined, but his days were plainly numbered. In the meantime, the orchestrated campaign by the Nazis to pressurize Groner into resignation proved successful. After rowdy scenes in the Reichstag during his speech on the 10th of May, and after being told by Schleicher that he had lost the confidence of the Reichswehr, Groner announced his resignation on the 12th of May. It was seen as the beginning of the end for Brüning. Hitler was extraordinarily content. The next day, Goebbels noted, "We get message from General Schleicher. The crisis continues according to plan." The last straw for Brüning was Hindenburg's displeasure, influenced by lobbying from fellow estate owners in eastern Germany at a planned emergency decree to break up bankrupt estates to create smallholder settlements. This was, however, only a contributory factor to Brüning's downfall. His deflationary policies that had precipitated the steepest economic collapse outside war witnessed in a modern industrial society had served their purpose. The end of reparations was now in sight and would effectively be brought about at the Lausanne conference only a few weeks later. With that, the move to the right that Hindenburg favored and Schleicher had worked for could now be actively implemented. On the 29th of May, Hindenburg brusquely sought Brüning's resignation. The following day, in the briefest of audiences, it was submitted. "The system is collapsing," wrote Goebbels. Hitler saw the Reich president that afternoon. "The meeting went well," he told his propaganda chief in the evening. "The SA ban will be dropped. Uniforms are to be allowed again. The Reichstag will be dissolved. That's the most important of all. Von Papen is foreseen as chancellor, but that is not so interesting. Voting, voting, out to the people. We're all very happy." 12. The new chancellor, Franz von Papen, an urbane and well-connected member of the Catholic nobility, a former diplomat and arch-conservative, formerly on the right of the Zentrum, had been sounded out by Schleicher some days before Brüning's fall. Schleicher had not only cleared the ground with Hindenburg for Papen's appointment, but had also drawn up a list of cabinet ministers and discussed the matter with some of them even before Papen agreed to serve. With his cabinet of barons, independent of parties, Papen made no pretense at parliamentary government. With no prospect of finding a majority in the Reichstag, he was dependent solely upon presidential emergency decrees and the toleration of the NSDAP. Just over a week after coming into office, he met Hitler for the first time. "I found him curiously unimpressive," wrote Papen after the war. "I could detect no inequality which might explain his extraordinary hold on the masses. He was wearing a dark blue suit and seemed the complete petit bourgeois. He had an unhealthy complexion, and, with his little moustache and curious hairstyle, had an indefinable bohemian quality. His demeanour was modest and polite, and although I had heard much about the magnetic quality of his eyes, I do not remember being impressed by them. As he talked about his party's aims, I was struck by the fanatical insistence with which he presented his arguments. I realized that the fate of my government would depend to a large extent on the willingness of this man and his followers to back me up, and that this would be the most difficult problem with which I should have to deal. He made it clear that he would not be content for long with a subordinate role, and intended in due course to demand plenary powers for himself. I regard your cabinet only as a temporary solution, and will continue my efforts to make my party the strongest in the country. The chancellorship will then devolve on me," he said. 5 days earlier, as prearranged, the Reich President had dissolved the Reichstag, setting new elections for the latest possible date, the 31st of July 1932. Hitler now had his chance to try to win power by the ballot box. State elections in Oldenburg at the end of May and in Mecklenburg-Schwerin on the 5th of June brought the NSDAP respectively 48.4 and 49.0% of the vote. On the 19th of June in Hessen, the Nazis increased their proportion of the vote there to 44%. An absolute majority in the Reichstag election did not seem out of the question. The second part of Schleicher's deal with Hitler, the lifting of the ban on the SA and SS, eventually took place after some delay on the 16th of June. It was already by then being openly flouted. It ushered in a summer of political violence throughout Germany such as had never been seen before. The latent civil war that had existed throughout the Weimar Republic was threatening to become an actual civil war. Armed clashes and street fighting between the SA and the communists were daily occurrences. Nazi violence, it might be thought, ought to have put off the respectable bourgeois following it was increasingly attracting. But since such Nazi supporters saw the threat as lying on the left, the anti-communist thuggery, purporting to serve the interests of the nation, alienated remarkably few voters. The level of violence was frightening. In the second half of June, after the lifting of the SA ban, there were 17 politically motivated murders. During July, there were a further 86 killings, mainly Nazis and communists. The numbers of those seriously injured rose into the hundreds. 4 were killed and 34 injured in a single clash on the 10th of July in Ohlau in Silesia. In the worst incident, the Altona Blood Sunday of the 17th of July, 17 people were killed and 64 injured as shooting broke out during an SA parade, seen as a direct provocation by the town's communists. The Papen government immediately took up plans it had temporarily postponed to depose the Prussian government, still headed by the Social Democrat Otto Braun, with another socialist, Karl Severing, as interior minister, and placed the largest state in Germany in the hands of a Reich Commissar. On the 20th of July, representatives of the Prussian government were told that they were deposed and that Papen was now acting as Reich Commissar for Prussia. The biggest and most important state, and the vital bulwark of social democracy, capitulated without resistance. Militant opposition would almost certainly have been futile. A general strike of the kind that had broken the back of the Kapp Putsch in 1920 was unthinkable with 6 million unemployed. There were fears, too, that an attempt at a general strike would provoke a military dictatorship. But the passivity of the main defender of the Republic in the face of such a blatant breach of the Constitution was desperately demoralizing for the SPD's supporters. And it showed Hitler he had little to fear from that quarter. Papen's destruction of the Prussian bastion without a blow being struck in anger was undertaken by conservatives, not Nazis. But it set the model for the takeover of power in the states more than 6 months before Hitler became Chancellor. Meanwhile, Hitler's party had entered upon its fourth election campaign within 4 months. Goebbels had claimed in mid-April that shortage of money was hindering propaganda. There was little sign of either money or energy being spared, however, as the propaganda machine was cranked up once more. Nazi toleration of the Papen government counted for little once the campaign was underway. But the main aim was to destroy the remnants of voting for the bourgeois splinter parties and attempt to make inroads into the Zentrum's support. There was a good deal of parading and pageantry. A novel touch was the use of film propaganda and production of 50,000 gramophone records of An Appeal to the Nation by Hitler. There was awareness that boredom with the constant electioneering was setting in. Hitler began a speaking marathon in 53 towns and cities during his third Germany flight. The monotony for his entourage was scarcely bearable. He arrived, gave his speech, had his bags packed, and left for the next venue. His attendants, commented Hanfstegel, were like boxing seconds who had to keep their man fit between rounds, in Hitler's case, speaking bouts. His theme was unchanged. The parties of the November Revolution had presided over the untold ruin of every aspect of German life. His own party was the only one that could rescue the German people from its misery. When the results were declared on the 31st of July, the Nazis could record another victory of sorts. They had increased their share of the vote to 37.4%. This made them, with 230 seats, easily the largest party in the Reichstag. The socialists had lost votes compared with 1930, the KPD and Centrum had made slight gains, the collapse of the bourgeois parties of the centre and right had advanced still further. The victory for the Nazis was, however, only a Pyrrhic one. Compared with the Reichstag election results of 1930, let alone 1928, their advance was indeed astonishing. But from a more short-term perspective, the outcome of the July election could even be regarded as disappointing. They had scarcely improved on the support they had won in the second presidential election and in the April state elections. Goebbels gave a sober assessment of the position. "We have won a tiny bit. Result? Now we must come to power and exterminate, ausrotten, Marxism. One way or another, something must happen. The time for opposition is over. Now, deeds." Hitler is of the same opinion. "Now events have to sort themselves out and then decisions have to be taken. We won't get to an absolute majority this way." On the 2nd of August, Hitler was still uncertain what to do. He talked over the possibilities of action with Goebbels while recuperating from the election campaign by the Tegernsee. A coalition with the Zentrum was one option briefly considered, but discarded. No conclusions were reached. It was decided to wait and see how things developed. Music, films, relaxation, and a visit to Tristan und Isolde in Munich filled the space. Within 2 days, while at Berchtesgaden, Hitler had decided how to play his hand. He arranged a meeting with Schleicher in Berlin to put his demands. The chancellorship for himself, interior ministry for Frick, air ministry for Goering, labor ministry for Strasser, and a ministry for the people's education, Volkserziehung, for Goebbels. He was confident that the barons would give way, but he left a question mark over the response of the old man, Hindenburg. The secret negotiations with Reichswehr Minister Schleicher at Fürstenberg, 50 miles north of Berlin, lasted for several hours on the 6th of August. When Hitler reported back to other Nazi leaders gathered at Berchtesgaden, he was confident. "Within a week the matter will burst open," thought Goebbels. "Chief will become Reich Chancellor and Prussian Minister President, Strasser Reich and Prussian Interior, Goebbels Prussian and Reich Education, Dare Agriculture in both, Frick, State Secretary in the Reich Chancellery, Goering, Air Ministry, Justice Ministry stays with us, Warmbold, Economy, Krosigk, that is, Schwern von Krosigk, Finance, Schacht, Reichsbank. A cabinet of men. If the Reichstag rejects the enabling act, it will be sent packing. Nach Hause geschickt. Hindenburg wants to die with a national cabinet. We will never give up power again. They'll have to carry us out as corpses. I still can't believe it. At the gates of power." The deal with Schleicher appeared to offer Hitler all he wanted. It was not total power, but there was little left wanting so far as internal power and control over domestic politics was concerned. From Schleicher's point of view, the concession of a Hitler chancellorship was a significant one. But the Reichswehr minister presumably reckoned that as long as the army remained under his own control, Hitler could be kept in check and would provide the popular basis for for an authoritarian regime in which he himself would continue to be the eminence grise. The prospect of a civil war, into which the Reichswehr might be drawn, would recede sharply, and the teeth of the Nazis would be drawn by the inevitable compromises they would have to make in the face of the realities of political responsibility. Such was the thinking behind all variants of a taming strategy which would unfold over the following months. Schleicher later claimed he had put Hitler's demands to the Reich president on the latter's estate in the Neudeck in East Prussia. Influential though he was with Hindenburg, Schleicher had been firmly rebuffed. The Reich president informed Schleicher in no uncertain terms, according to the Reichswehr minister's account, that it was his irrevocable will not to appoint Hitler to the chancellorship. Just after Hindenburg had returned from Neudeck to Berlin on the 10th of August, Papen had also raised with him the possibility of a Hitler chancellorship, heading a brown-black majority government of NSDAP and Centrum. It was at this meeting that Hindenburg made his contemptuous remark, frequently cited, that it would be a fine thing indeed were he to make the Bohemian corporal Reich Chancellor. In the dark about these developments, Hitler and Goebbels talked over the problems of the seizure of power. Goebbels was rapturous about the historic task facing him in the national education of the German people. Nazi supporters scented triumph. The whole party expected power, it was reported by telephone from Berlin. The leader of the Berlin SA, Graf Heldorf, was unfolding his own big plans for the takeover of power. Stormtroopers were leaving work in expectation of what was about to happen. Party functionaries were in readiness for the great hour. "If things go badly, there'll be a dreadful backlash," commented Goebbels. The Papen government was divided on whether Hitler should be given power. Finance Minister Krosigk thought the best way to avoid civil war was to turn the poacher into a gamekeeper. The Minister of the Interior, Freiherr von Gehl, vehemently opposed any such idea. Supported by Foreign Minister Neurath, he proposed retention of the existing government, acknowledging that this would require a breach of the Constitution. The Reichstag should be dissolved, but no date set for fresh elections, and a new restricted franchise imposed. Justice Minister Gertner hedged his bets. To continue the current cabinet without new elections would indeed be unconstitutional. He voiced no disapproval of the inclusion in government of the National Socialists, whose idea of the state, he pointed out, rested on their instinct for retaliation, Vergeltungsinstinkt, against Jews and Marxists, but feared the notion was illusory unless they were to be offered leadership of the government. Other cabinet ministers favoured a continuation of the current administration. Papen and Schleicher wanted to keep their options open. While Gehl was publicly announcing, ironically in a speech on Constitution Day, the 11th of August, his wish to replace the Weimar Constitution by an authoritarian system where government was not dependent upon the Reichstag, the armed SA were demonstratively taking up positions of apparent readiness for action around the government quarter of Berlin. "Makes the gentleman very nervous," wrote Goebbels. "That's the point of the exercise." On the 11th of August, Hitler held a last conference with party leaders at Prien on the Chiemsee, the biggest of the Bavarian lakes, 80 or so miles east of Munich, close to the Austrian border. He was by now aware of the growing opposition in the corridors of power to his chancellorship. There was still the possibility of threatening a coalition with the Zentrum, but Hitler was adamant that nothing less than the chancellorship would do. After resting in his flat in Munich, he travelled next day to Berlin by car to avoid all publicity. Röhm had meetings with Schleicher and Papen that day, the 12th of August, but his soundings about a Hitler chancellorship were inconclusive. Hitler arrived in darkness at Goebbels's house in Kaputt on the outskirts of Berlin in the late evening. He was told that matters were still unresolved after Röhm's meetings. It was now either or, he insisted. But if it had been as simple as that, he would not have spent what was left of the evening pacing up and down, pondering how much hinged on the decision of the Reich president. It was clear to Goebbels what was at stake. Unless Hitler were to be given extensive power, meaning the chancellorship, he would have to refuse office. In that case, a mighty depression in the movement and in the electorate would be the consequence. He added, "And we have only this one iron in the fire." The following morning, the 13th of August, accompanied by Röhm, Hitler met Schleicher, followed shortly afterwards, this time together with Frick, by a meeting with Chancellor Papen. He was informed by both that Hindenburg was not prepared to appoint him Chancellor. I soon realized that I was dealing with a very different man from the one I had met 2 months earlier, von Papen recalled.